there is a wealth of possibilities, of possible positive channels through which the emigration of high-skilled individuals can positively impact development back home.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Many developed countries are creating immigration policies at the moment. They're designed specifically to attract the most talented migrants. Emigration of those skilled, educated citizens from low-income countries, well, that's going to risk causing a brain drain at home, which might delay or might hobble development. A new article in the journal Science puts that assumption to the test. Katia Batista of Nova School of Business and Economics and Caroline Theoharides of Amherst College are two of the authors of that article, and they both join me now. Katia, welcome.
Thank you for having us, Tim. It's a very wonderful opportunity.
And Caroline, hello as well.
Hello, Tim.
Caroline, advanced economies, some of them are pretty close to full employment. They're short of all types of workers. Why are they trying to attract only the best and the brightest immigrants in their policies?
One of the key goals of immigration policy is to reduce critical labor and skill shortages. And so as you point out, these shortages exist for lots of levels of skill. And I think it's often the case that it's more politically palatable to bring in these highly skilled immigrants.
And Katia, why is it that at the other end, talented people choose to become migrants, to leave their countries of origin and their homes, their families, perhaps?
Well, I think that depends a lot. That depends on the countries they are coming from, the opportunities they have at home, but then also on their individual profiles, because we know that many times, most of these talented migrants are young people that are looking for international experience abroad. And this could be something that, well, maybe it's just different from what they have at home, especially if they are coming from higher income countries. This could apply also in middle income economies where, they are looking for this international career, but they are also looking for much better opportunities in terms of career and wages. If we look at low income countries, then the situation is a bit different because there they may lack conditions for them to exert their jobs. If you think of IT engineers or medical professionals, maybe they want to leave not only because wages are higher abroad, but also because they don't have basic conditions to use their talents back home. So it will depend a lot, really. We are talking about a very broad phenomenon here and many different individual decisions.
Yes, it is a broad phenomenon, but if we're talking about the best, the most talented, what sort of jobs are we talking about that they will emigrate to do in other countries?
I think we're thinking about all sorts of jobs. Much of the media attention is often on medical workers. I think this is particularly true given the potential for externalities on local health in the country of origin. Mm-hmm. But broadly, I think the literature has often been a bit vague, and this is one of the points we try to make in our paper, is that really we've broadly thought about this as any tertiary educated worker is highly skilled.
Right, yeah.
But one of the things our research also tries to discuss, while we do discuss this broad base of research, is we try to think about estimates that depend on education level. So are these high academic achievers? Do they have a bachelor's degree? Do they have a PhD? And then what are the occupations? Are we thinking about inventors and scientists? Are we thinking about medical professionals? Are we thinking about engineers? Because I think we think that specifying the type of high-skilled worker specifically that we're considering is going to be really important for the policy implications and also for the potential impact on origin countries. So we're thinking about this broadly, but we want to encourage all of our listeners to think about this specifically in terms of the potential policy implications.
Given that, I'll let you set the terms. Do we know how large this potential brain drain outflow is and if it's increasing and from which countries to which countries?
So broadly, 18% of all individuals from low-income countries with a bachelor's degree are living in the OECD. So that's a pretty high number. This varies by country and skill category. So I can give you some examples. So for example, in Ethiopia, 91% of PhD holders are abroad, 91%. If we compare that to Germany, that's 3%. So really a lot of variation in terms of how you think about this. Cape Verde has 40% of bachelor's degree recipients abroad, compared with 13% for sub-Saharan Africa more broadly, or 4% for high-income countries. So there's a lot of variation across countries. Globally, if we think about highly skilled immigrants, they come from all countries, but the highest numbers in terms of levels are from India, China, the Philippines, and Mexico. These are also the largest centers of migrants globally at any level of skill, but it also applies for high levels of skill. I think you asked about increases as well. And so in terms of increases, between 2000 and 2020, the share of migrants with tertiary education rose from 28% to 38% for those born outside the OECD. But I also think about this a lot in terms of like the field, not just the country of origin. And so I think one example to highlight is that like from the COVID-19 pandemic, this highlighted the already present shortages of healthcare workers. And so what we saw was, for example, US regulatory bodies, I think we saw this in the UK as well, expedited recognition of international qualifications during this period. And so we saw pretty rapid changes in terms of particular occupations and how these flows worked given these potential shortages.
This article is called Brain Drain or Brain Gain. Explain this question to me. What question are you trying to answer in the article?
Our starting point is the fact that most people just assume brain drain. When you see the highly skilled leaving a country, you just assume that country is being depleted of human capital. And then people assume it theoretically, they don't really look too much at the evidence or even at the theoretical possibilities of brain gains. And so I guess that's the starting point. We wanted, first of all, to put forward the theoretical hypothesis that, well, there are actually potential channels through which the origin country may gain when high-skilled individuals leave the country. For example, it may be that, okay, and let's start theoretical and then we'll look at the evidence, but it could be, for example, that when educated people are leaving the country, they actually incentivize people back home to invest more in education and that the net result is more educated people in the home country as opposed to less. It is also a theoretical possibility that we investigate that when you have a large educated diaspora, you are actually sending back not only financial remittances, which is more recognized, but immaterial remittances. And what we mean by this is that people are sending back different norms, say, for political participation, for gender equality, that actually can promote economic development back home because these better institutions can open up avenues for economic development. And then you have even, I mean, more direct potential theoretical positive gains from, for example, return migrants that come back with new skills, with savings that are more entrepreneurial. Or going back to the diasporas, they can also promote links that will end up creating or attracting more foreign direct investment to the home country, more trade linkages. So there is a wealth of possibilities, of possible positive channels through which the emigration of high-skilled individuals can positively impact development back home. What we do in the paper is we first put out these hypotheses theoretically, and then we review the most recent rigorous evidence that shows that, well, actually, this has taken place. All of these channels have empirical support in many different contexts. So that's our starting point. This is not to say that there could not be challenges, which there are, obviously, but this is the starting point. Just do not assume there will be a brain drain when you see highly skilled people leaving a country.
The evidence that you're capturing from this is from existing studies on migration patterns, is it?
Yes, exactly.
In the last 20 years, we have seen more and more studies about these topics, trying to test these different positive channels through which high-skilled emigration can affect positively the development in origin countries. What we did here is we tried to select. First, we are focusing on the emigration of the highly skilled, defined as those that could complete tertiary education. Okay, so most of the studies, we base ourselves focusing on highly skilled emigration. And then we focus on the most recent studies using the most rigorous empirical methodologies, a lot of them experimental or quasi-experimental.
So first of all, examples of how the incentives for would-be immigrants to train or study has helped the origin country. Is there research that shows that to be true?
One helpful example It might be from some of my work with Paolo Abarcar on Filipino nurses. When the U.S. expanded visas for nurses in 2000, there was really dramatic enrollment response in Filipino nursing programs. Between 2000 and 2006, the U.S. expanded the number of visas for foreign nurses, and this expansion was by about 26,000 visas. But what we see in the Philippines is that this new opportunity encouraged many, many more people to train as nurses. And this resulted in almost 114,000 newly licensed nurses over this period. So what this led to was an increase of about 86,000 nurses in the Philippines. In our paper, we showed that this actually led to a meaningful increase in the number of individuals who actually were employed as nurses in the Philippines, so working in Filipino hospitals as nurses. One thing I want to highlight, though, here is that in the case of the Philippines, it was actually crucial for this response that the supply of schooling responded to enable this increase in enrollment. Okay, and so I think without such a supply response, the brain gain effects that we find might not be possible. Thinking about the specific context and how flexible the education system is really important to think about. Similarly, our co-author on this paper, Gaurav Khanna, has a paper where he shows that in India, when the H-1B cap in the US was relaxed to allow more IT workers, India actually gained more IT professionals. And so there was this IT sector that built up in India in response to this.
So let's also talk about remittances, because that's a very well-known part of the story of migration. When do these remittances have a brain gain impact? Because we usually think about them as being sent home just to, for example, increase consumption, to help the family at home. Now, I can see that that's very important, but it's not necessarily a brain gain impact.
Let's try to define brain gain, first of all, right? I guess the most direct impact that we were talking about was incentives for people to acquire additional education, right? And if we think about low-income countries, it may be that these remittances that you are sending that are fueling consumption are actually a necessary condition for people to be able to study, right? These are the remittances that will allow them to have proper food, proper housing, and not having to work instead of studying. So this actually may be condition for them to be able to study. So Caroline was highlighting how important at the more macro level it is that you have infrastructures that support the possibility of people to acquire education on the supply side. But now, maybe if we look at those individuals that are deciding to make the decision to study further or not, financial remittance can actually be very important, even in what we label as consumption, because they will allow people to study. They may also allow people to, say, buy the books and all the other expenses associated with education. Even the early literature shows exactly this. Financial remittances can play an important role in supporting education. So we are talking about the newer literature on the incentive effects to acquire extra education because of the emigration of the highly skilled, but these may be the basics that are also enabled by migration and remittances.
In addition to some of these benefits from consumption, I think remittances are also often invested, and we see that remittances are often invested in education. So there's been some recent evidence that shows that when there are positive shocks to migrant income, this can lead to the promotion of investment in education and in small enterprises.
I was just focusing on the impact on education, but the truth is that financial remittances do support many other positive developments back home that are brain gain. I mean, if you think about entrepreneurial developments, that's an obvious one, but there are more indirect ones. So we were discussing this transmission of norms. When you think about people getting more demanding for more political accountability, for better institutions, if they have the economic welfare to not be worried about getting food on the plate, on their plates every day, they'll be freer to absorb these new norms, to make changes, political changes, societal changes. So financial remittances, I think, do provide a lot of important basic conditions for people then to invest in education, to promote political and societal change. So financial remittances are really important. They are the more obvious benefit of emigration, but it does not mean that they are not still very important in addition to all the other less obvious brain gain channels that we exploit in this article.
Diaspora networks in other countries, very often these immigrants can do quite well and they establish lives and financial independence. their influence on their home country, is that about investment back into the home country, or can the diaspora have a bigger brain gain impact as well?
I think the diaspora can certainly lead to financial investment, and this can happen either through some of the remittance effects, like exactly what Katya was just talking about,
sure,
or through broader investment in the communities of origin. Going to the last point that Katya was just saying, I think the diaspora can also lead to the sharing of ideas and knowledge, and it can also lead to trade linkages. So I think one nice example to think about here is that there's some evidence that shows that when there are larger migrant networks, there's more FDI to migrants' origin countries. There's also other evidence that shows that migrant networks can increase manufacturing output in the migrant's country of origin. And I think these diasporas can also facilitate connections between importers and exporters and enable access to new types of markets abroad. I think on the other hand, we also might want to consider that business development may vary with the type of migrant. And so skilled workers who might be departing from conflict zones or places with lots of political repression, for example, might be less likely to invest at home. And so the direct loss of this skilled labor could be a dominant effect in those settings. Not necessarily, but I think it's probably something we need more evidence on, since a lot of the evidence we have is coming from large economies, a bit more well-developed, like the Philippines or Mexico or something like that.
Some migrants will return to their home countries, and they can bring with them financial investment, but can they also bring knowledge that they have accumulated from migration to other countries? I'm thinking about management knowledge, entrepreneurial skills, which will be useful in the home country.
A really nice example for this is thinking about immigrant IT sector workers who returned home from India when their visas expired. And so what we see here is that their return led to subsequent offshoring of IT production from the US to India. I think similarly, these returnees bring back ideas, they bring back insights, they bring back practices from abroad that can just broadly enhance this knowledge base. And so we've seen this in contexts such as patenting activity, productivity of academic research. And I want to highlight that this doesn't necessarily require return migration, because this can happen remotely through networks. The rise of Zoom and WhatsApp and things like that, all of these like technological innovations have led to these connections being tighter even without that actual return migration. One other example that's maybe nice to highlight is in China. Provinces were trying to attract returnees by providing incentives. And what they show is that these resident companies in these provinces that attracted returnees got people with foreign experience, and they were able to improve management practices and have higher profits as a result. On the other hand, there's like potential cost to this, is that losing these potential inventors through brain drain could inhibit economic growth and innovation. And so I think this really underscores the need to consider policies that maximize local innovation when we promote innovator emigration. So how can we develop policies that are going to maximize these goals of local innovation and really take advantage of these networks that are developing across borders and enhancing the knowledge base?
Okay, yes, let's talk about policy now. What would be the message that you have from this article and from your individual research for policymakers who are worried about brain drain and are trying to think of ways to discourage emigration?
The starting point is the same as our question, which is, do not assume a brain drain. Do not assume that because people are leaving, the origin country will be harmed. I think we present enough rigorous evidence from different contexts that shows that there is surely a possibility that high-skilled emigration will benefit origin countries. This is, however, not guaranteed at all. Okay, so there is more work to do. We cannot just say, don't discourage emigration because this will be good for sure for the origin country. So there are some caveats here, some discussion to be had, some work for policymakers to do in order for them to be able to reap the benefits of high-skilled emigration. But the main message that we convey here is the possibility of brain gains, of a benefit for origin countries, is surely there through a variety of channels.
Your point about how this expands education and gives many more people an incentive to pursue education. How can these skills be employed for people who do not migrate, who have invested in their education, but then never leave the country?
I think one way through which the high-skilled emigrants are actually making things better for those that stay home with their skills is that, well, actually, the fact that policymakers realize that Well, these highly skilled immigrants have an opportunity to go abroad, to work. They have good conditions. It will create some pressure for these conditions to be better at home, or at least they should. Okay, so if you think of it in this way, there could be here an opportunity and an incentive for policymakers to make things better for the highly educated workers that did decide for time being to stay back home. Okay, if they really want to benefit from these educated people that are staying in the country, they should also invest in them. And I think that's a powerful message, that the fact that people are immigrating will bring back home.
Thinking about the impacts that this has on political and social norms back in the countries of origin, Katya has a lot of work that I'll let her talk about on the political norm side. I've done some work and others have done work thinking about changes in fertility norms and reproductive health decisions. And so some of the work that we've done recently has shown that reproductive health policies abroad and the destination countries for these migrants, these norms are actually transmitted back in such a way that they lower fertility, they encourage modern contraceptive adoption of not just the migrants themselves, but spillovers to their local communities. And so I think that that's not necessarily just on the education side, but I think we can think about that having broad implications for even structural change within these local economies.
At this point, we have plenty of evidence on how migrants are a force for political change. This is actually not that recent. We have classical authors like Hirschman talking about exit and voice, the role that migrants have in political change when they decide to stay in their home country, to leave. I think the most recent evidence, what it shows is that when people leave, when they keep in touch with people back home, they actually do transmit the possibility of doing things in different ways. And here there is an important caveat that has been highlighted in the literature, which is it depends a lot on where migrants are going. So if migrants are going to places where democracies function better, where people are more active, vocalizing their demands, where they are more demanding in terms of political accountability, all of these things can be transferred back home and they can promote political change for the better back home. This is not universal in the sense that there are examples of the opposite, of migrants going to countries where, say, female rights are not as respected, and they also do transmit this back home and they become more conservative. I think what we learn here is that migrants are powerful channels to transmit political and social norms.
Should policy be trying to attract these migrants back to their home countries?
There is no easy answer for your question, I guess. But what is important here is that more than necessarily trying to attract people back home is to make sure that there are good conditions at home so that the country can benefit from those that decide to emigrate. Okay, so this has to do with what Caroline was referring to before, say, having the educational infrastructures, the environment in which people, if they do decide to invest in more education, they can do so. So this is a very important one. One thing that I should say that we do not know about, and hence we can say less, is that we need more research that looks at smaller, lower-income countries. By now, we have some research on middle-income countries, but we should have more on low-income countries where this kind of barriers tends to be stronger. We also need to look more at longer time horizons, because many times for us to achieve a well-identified study where we can be confident about establishing a causal relationship, we look at big shocks. The big shocks sometimes induce changes that are not so typical or that we can automatically transfer to the kind of emigration that is happening every day in a more constant manner. So here, we also need to have more evidence and say, more policy experiments. I would say that, okay, answering more directly to your question, if policymakers decide that they want to attract back more immigrants, well, that would be something that we could definitely test and try to measure the impact of. And in this long time framework, trying to understand exactly what are the impacts, not only very specific for those people, but more general equilibrium over time. And I mean, trying to learn more so that we can then have more to say in answer to your question.
I think similarly, rather than thinking about, you know, should we get people to return or should we just think about the increase in the human capital stock that might have happened through incentivization of migration that isn't realized, I think one of the key barriers, whichever population you're thinking about, is thinking about the welfare gains from brain gain and how well this new human capital can be utilized in the country of origin. The work that I mentioned earlier in the Philippines shows substantial gains in the number of licensed Filipino nurses. But if you talk to people in the Philippines, they'll still report that lots of Filipino hospitals report shortages of healthcare workers.
Yes.
And so I think that many of these people who trained as nurses, who got an education as a nurse, who now have a college degree they may not have attained before, they may actually remain in the Philippines and choose never to work as a nurse. They often report low wages, really poor working conditions in local hospitals. And so while what we show is that the stock of medical workers is increased, the country may not actually reap the benefits of this. What we really need to think about now is what policy ideas are there and how can we test them to think about how to best integrate these workers into the local economy so that we can capture the full extent of this brain gain. I think in general, there's a lot less research, as Katya was saying, about the effectiveness of these various policy actions to maximize brain gain so that it's welfare enhancing. And so thinking about maybe like innovative ways to fund education through things like global skills partnerships between origin and destination countries, or like how we can better engage the diaspora, whether they return or not. I think these are all have a lot of promise, but we need to think about rigorously testing these so that these origin countries really can take advantage of the fact that they've increased the base of educated workers. But how do we actually make this work in a way that's welfare enhancing?
A few weeks ago, we spoke to Jonas Alamu, who set up Lovegrass Ethiopia. He is a great example of the sort of thing that we're talking about. He made a career for himself in Europe and in the UK, but then decided that he wanted to invest in Ethiopia and build a business there. One of the things he said about that is it was pretty difficult to do that. He ran into all sorts of just day-to-day problems in building and scaling a business. And he was saying that that's a huge challenge because he wasn't short of talent or people who wanted to work hard. It was just difficult to do that. Again, is this a policy challenge just to make it easier to invest in businesses for entrepreneurs to build businesses in the home country to take advantage of that brain gain effect?
Absolutely. I think that that's one of the things that I think about in terms of where we have this evidence. We have it in these middle-income countries that are relatively large. How is this going to work in places where there are more restrictions, where there's maybe more conflict, or the economy is more fragile, there are less strong democratic institutions? Are we going to see these same effects? Maybe there's not an incentive to invest back in businesses or for foreign direct investment when the economy is much less stable. And so thinking about the ways the government can ensure that these remittance flows or diaspora investment can flow back in a way that's meaningful and that's effective and isn't caught up in red tape is going to allow this to be a much more impactful transfer between wealthy countries where the migrants may be located and back home again.
It's a fascinating story, and there is so much more that we could talk about. Thank you for talking about it today, though. Thank you, Katya.
Thank you, Tim.
And thank you, Caroline, as well.
Thank you, Tim.
Read that article. It is called Brain Drain or Brain Gain: Effects of High-Skilled International Emigration on Origin Countries. And the authors, there are a lot of them, covering quite a lot of work on this: Katya Batista, Daniel Han, Johannes Haushofer, Gaurav Khanna, David McKenzie, Ahmed Mushfiq Mubarak, Caroline Theoharides, and Dean Yang. It is published in Science number 388, 2025, of course. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, well, follow us wherever you get your podcasts. You will find us there. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you also find articles about the topics we feature. And if you like what you hear, please tell someone else about us. Leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at VoxDev.